CliffCentral.com.
All right, so we're going to meet a man who Bulelo introduced us to last week. He said that this guy is the inaugural and rightful person for us to first meet on the top spot of Bunch of Winners. His name is David Greer, and he's in studio this morning to tell us about his adventure of a life. There's lots to talk to him about since he's had enough adventure to last about three lifetimes. And we were talking just now about living forever, David, but it doesn't seem like you have to because you're already living.
Lived enough.
Yeah, you know, it seems like you're already living what the rest of us just sit at home and watch on TV. You're actually getting to do.
No, but I was listening to you earlier on and I was thinking, hell, if I could have that 25, 30-year-old body and,
imagine
and
what
the experience that I've had now of adventuring and put the two together, that would be my ultimate.
You'd last forever, man.
Well, it's cool.
A great pleasure to meet you. Tell us a little bit about your background, because Bulelo was singing your praises the other day about all the things that you've done. I think it's also worth mentioning that you're a trustee and ambassador for the Sipla Miles for Smiles Foundation. A lot of our listeners knew who you were before Bulelo introduced you to us. But you raise funds for Operation Smile, which obviously performs great corrective surgery on kids who are born with cleft lips and palates and helps them in a lot of ways. So it's a great pleasure to actually sit with you and talk to you. How did you end up doing all this interesting stuff? How did you end up with such a full life, and where did it all begin?
It began, I'd been a chef for about 35 years. I had quite a few of my own restaurants, sort of fine dining restaurants from the Eastern Transvaal down into the Cape when I moved back home. And at one stage, I weighed close to 115 kilos.
No way.
Just at the age
You're
of just
big,
over.
Fat man.
Yeah,
really?
I was a big porker. And
but they say you should never trust a thin chef.
Yeah, I don't
Good
know.
Point.
I'm cooking at my best now that I'm always hungry and doing something about it. My taste buds are always inspired, and the smells around me sort of excite me more now than I was. So fat and unable to do much. But so at that age, I just thought, hell, I've got to do something about this. And I started running, and I started with 10Ks and then 21Ks, and then I started doing marathons. And then I got into adventure racing. And I found the further I went, the better I became at running. And I'd been in an adventure racing team, and we did quite well in the South African series. It was long ago when adventure racing started. And then I thought, I'd really like to challenge myself on something massive. And China has always intrigued me, and the Great Wall had always intrigued me. So I set out trying to put an adventure together in order to run the Great Wall. And I was rejected time and time again. I took the total wrong route. I tried to do it officially. And I couldn't get anywhere. Whenever I try to get some department in the Chinese government to do this, to do that, nothing happened.
Red tape everywhere, right.
Then, searching on the web, I came up with this guy called William Lindsay. Mm-hmm. And 25 years ago, he'd done this solo journey on the Great Wall. So he started in the east, and it got so hot when he hit the mountains in the Hebei province around Beijing, he had to abort it. Then he traveled all the way to the west, the Gobi Desert. And he started the run again. And then he got to the Shanxi province, a city called Yulin, and he got arrested as a spy. And he was imprisoned in a hotel there. And he was deported. Then he He went back to China again, and he started running again, and then he got dysentery. And then he went back home again, and he came back again.
All right, he's clearly mentally ill, this guy.
And this is the guy that inspired you?
Yeah.
I'm just checking.
I thought, this mullet is going to get me there. And I'd sent him, honestly, about 40 emails.
Yeah?
And finally, I got a reply, and he said to me, you are so persistent, I have to answer you. But what you're trying to do, I feel, is impossible, because I've tried myself, and I couldn't do it in one go.
Yeah.
So he said, I'll assist you. And that's where the door of this ultra adventuring opened. And he put a team together. And in 2006, that's where the journey began. And we managed to do the whole Great Wall, 4,200 kilometers in 98 days, averaging a marathon a day.
But there's some parts of the Great Wall you can't run on.
Yeah, I'd say, look, there's a lot of myth about the Great Wall. You can't see it from space. When that astronaut went up and the Chinese asked him, did you see the Great Wall? He said, no, I was looking out the wrong window. But every 500 meters, there's a turret or a tower. And the tower is about 2 meters above the wall. There was a wooden ladder so the soldiers could get into the turret. If someone came, they'd pull the ladder up. So you can't run horses along the wall either. So I'd say 90% of the wall you can't run on. It's only the revamped bits.
So what do you do then? Do you just run next to it?
You run next to it. Okay. Yeah. And 2,000 kilometers of the wall is mud. It's packed mud wall. It's 6-7 meters at the base and about 5 meters high. Ram earth mud wall. 2,000 across the Gobi and Tangier Desert. So, and those walls have been standing. They started building the wall over 2,000 years ago.
It's phenomenal.
Yeah. They used 230 million man years to build that wall. I mean,
it's just extraordinary.
It's incredible. And it's and it's rumored for every step you take on the wall, someone perished in the process of building the wall.
Oh, wow.
Not on the wall itself, but, you know, the support and the families around and all of that.
Course.
So it's incredible structure.
Human feat of engineering.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
But when you go, did you go from east to west or west to east?
I went back 14 months ago, 18 months ago, and ran it again in the other direction.
So you've done both?
Yeah, so I'm now the first person issued to run it west to east and east to west.
Amazing.
But what we did on the second run is we wanted to see if we can do it at an ultra a day. So I ran with Andrew Stewart. I've done the last 5 adventures with. And we averaged 61 kilometers a day for 78. So we did it in 78 days. So we knocked off 20 days.
That is unbelievable. What's easier, east to west to east? Obviously, with the ultra part, you must have found the latter.
You know, when you run west to east, you start at 1,500 meters and you've got about 1,800 kilometers of desert plateaus. So you get really fit and you lose a lot of weight. When you start in the east, we had 25 kilometers and straight into the mountains and up to 2,000 meters. So it was so hard the second time round because everything was in reverse and we never had time to get fit. And we took a hammering this time. But we
And you just did it as a tourist. You didn't tell them you were going to do it and go through, because otherwise there's just too much of a nightmare.
Yeah, we did it on tourist visas.
Yeah.
But, you know, talking about China as well, it's that country's intrigued me. And there's so much amazing stuff happening. And we get a perception of China.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I've lived there in villages and on the ground and under bridges for close to a year now on these adventures. And I've met the real folk. I've been into the northwest of China where there are no-go zones. They signs saying aliens not welcome. They call you aliens and you can't sleep in certain villages and whatever. But if I take from 2006 to now, the Green Revolution in China, in, I think, 2017, 2018, they rolled out more solar farms than the U.S. has done in the last 15 years in the northwest.
That brought more people out of poverty than at any other point in human history. It's just a tremendous
thing. It's amazing to see that side. But to journey there, it's been a privilege. Yeah.
And did you have people with you who could help translate and help you figure out where to stay? And
So you in a country like that, you have a ground crew. Some places we don't, some we do. So the crew will try and intersect you wherever you can meet. So maybe you've a couple of days on your own, a week or longer. And then the crew will intercept you, and then they will have tents, they'll have food, you re-kit whatever you need, change shoes and that, and then off you go again. So you take the shortest possible route, and they intersect you all the time trying to assist you and find places.
But just besides the amount of time you spent, like the 40 emails and all of that kind of stuff, but putting together a trek like that, what kind of planning, how much planning goes into it? You know, what does it take in terms of planning and budgeting and all of those things?
You know, they say that 95% of all adventures fail. Not on the adventure, but people give up before the first step because it's so hard to do exactly what you're talking about. You know, to get the funds, I've done 10 of these massive world first adventures now, and I still cannot get funding. It takes me 18 months to 2 years, or even longer, 3 years, to get funding for an event. Normally you have to self-fund, and then you'll get a couple of people along when they see, okay, now they believe you actually are going to do it. So it's so difficult, and it's your passion, your drive, and your belief in getting there that gets you there. With planning, I've learned that you can plan to where you land, where you take your first step, and you plan how to get home after you've taken your last step. What happens in the beginning, you have no control over. You don't even plan it. just arrive here.
You just got to go with the flow.
You have to.
And if it takes you an extra day or two here or there, then you have to just go with it.
Yeah, there's injury. There's
so how long did you spend in any, you know, single stretch in China? I mean, how long were you there for? Not in total, but because you did go once, that you went again.
And
so you've been there a few times, but I mean, like, what was the longest stretch?
4 months.
4 months.
Yeah, yeah.
Jeez, do you remember what your family looked like after that?
you only just remember,
And back here, everybody else is running things and making sure that, you know, in other words, you're not taking a break from life.
No.
You're not completely cutting yourself off.
No, you know, it sounds weird. You basically set up your life that you might not come back. So you make sure that everything's in place and off you go. You know, if you think of these transatlantic rows and you think of Chris Burtish and that on his sailboard and that, I mean, when he kicks off the ocean, you know, it's where the current and wind takes him. And on land, it's a little less. I mean, I did a similar paddle. I paddled from Africa to Madagascar.
Yeah.
And it was when I left the coast.
500 kilometers in 12 days.
Yeah, I thought to myself, you stupid idiot. Where are you going? What are you doing?
And what, so I mean, everyone who travels says you learn a lot about yourself in traveling. You find yourself in traveling. And what have you learned about yourself in all of these adventures?
You know, that introflection is amazing and it's incredible. And it's that appreciation for everything and everyone that's taken away from you when you embark on these journeys. I mean, your culture, your language, your everything is taken. You're nothing. And you survive on those interactions and those first time meetings with people you meet along the way. And you learn so much about yourself and the respect for others and how we need each other. It is so important to people to be able to do that. And it changes your whole perception on people around you and that. And how interconnected we are as people. And our first impression of anyone is actually, how can I help you? That's the second thought is normally the dodgy one. So if you always act on that first thought, it's always like you meet someone, think, geez, I want to do something. I want to help you. How can I help you? And then the second thought comes in, then you shy away or you do this or that. But it's you learn so much about that and just appreciate what you have and just appreciate your fitness, your health, your family, your support, those words of encouragement. All the little things mean so much to you in life.
You know, so can you do a normal marathon like the Comrades, which, you know, even I've seen people who, you know, morbidly obese people run the Comrades and some of them obviously don't finish. But is that boring to you compared to all these things you've done?
No, it's not. You know, everything you do, if I want to run a 21K, it's a mental adjustment. I know where I'm going to start and where I'm going to finish. And you go. I mean, I'm a tractor. I plod. I've learned my running's about body maintenance. It's not speed. The faster you go, the more I injure myself.
That's smart.
But it's each thing is as hard. I mean, if I run a marathon now, it'll be hard because that's where I set it. If someone moves, I mean, all runners say, if you run 42 and they say, no, you've got to run 45 now, half of you will collapse. You can't do that those last 3Ks, although you can. It's just it's the mindset.
So you've gone up Kilimanjaro. You've done the Two Oceans a couple of times. You ran the entire length of India, 4,008 kilometers in 93 days.
Yeah, that was mentally probably the hardest run I've ever done. We started in Jammu, Kashmir, at the most northern Hindi temple. It was about 80 k's from Afghanistan up there. And we came down through that, and it was minus 10 in the beginning. It was freezing cold, and I ruptured.
Up in the Hindu Kush.
Yeah, right up. And I'd ruptured my bladder. So I was passing blood in my urine, and I thought I'd had a reoccurrence of bilharzia because I had really bad bilharzia that I picked up in Madagascar. And the guy says, no, you've got to get into a hospital. Yeah. So I went into this hospital, and they did a whole lot of blood tests. And they said, look here, they don't know. I must go for a scan.
In the middle of India.
Yeah, I remember going outside down the street and lining up all these pregnant ladies waiting my turn to go in this cubicle for a scan. And I came back to this doctor, and he said, and he looked at the scans, he says, no, he thinks I've got prostate cancer.
Oh, Jesus.
I said, come on, man. I've run 1,000 Ks. Anyway, eventually, I'd actually ruptured my bladder. The bladder had sagged with the cold and running downhill. It was 400 kilometers, and we came down a few thousand meters. And
this would put most people off. Most people at this point would go, you know what? My body's telling me that this running is going to kill it. I'm going to stop. Not you.
Yeah, I did. I don't know what.
What did you do? So you got the operation?
Well, I went into theatre and I came out there feeling a bit violated. And when I share this story, I always say there was the craziest thing was there were these five doctors in jeans and white t-shirts standing in this theatre, and there was a table like this black table, just like marble. And one had a glove, and you know, you sort of think, are you going to share that glove, or what's going to happen? But yeah, I came out of that, and it ruptured again and again.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I got to the end. But
how long did it take you to get this sorted out before you could carry on?
The next day, I started walking on the road again. Man. Yeah. And then some of the crew, Andrew, that's how I started running with Andy. He was in crew. He was a crew. Then he says, no, bro, I'm gonna join you on the road. And he helped me so much. And I used to do quite a bit on my own. And from then I learned, you want to do it with someone. You want to share it. You want that hand to be there to pull you back. And it was an amazing experience.
It is amazing. But you're...
What? Hold up. So, like, what actually happens in your mind when you come out of theater and... You, as harrowing an experience as the theater experience was, and the next morning you get up and you walk down this road.
You know, the answer to that came actually from this China run from Andrew. It's in you. It's we'd made a promise before we left to people we might never meet, but we made a promise we're going to assist them, we're going to change their lives. And Andy got a bad injury in China, and we wanted to can everything.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually came out of a hospital on crutches. He had such bad tendonitis that his ankle had seized.
Oh my God.
With a moon boot. And we'd only done, 800 Ks. And Andy sat there, and we stopped for 3 days, and he said, there is no ways we're giving up. We can't let these people down that have believed in us. We're gonna get there. And it was a similar thing. You walk out of that theater and you think, you know what? It's not about me. It's about that promise I made to those kids out there, the people that believe me, the people that have got me here. And it's, you know, it's not about us. We're messengers. We're sharing what can be done in this country. We're sharing amazing self-belief and inspiration and hope for everyone out there. Because, you know, if I look at now what we're doing, there's so many amazing, innovative stuff we're doing, and we're doing so much social innovation out there that are changing the landscape in many sectors across South Africa, and we're quietly doing it, and it's we don't want to stop that. We don't want to let people down, and we're bearing the fruits of that, and that's what drives us and makes you take that next step. If it was for me, I would have failed.
I'm curious also about how you treat the travel part of this, because it's not a conventional, you know, people buy an airline ticket and go and see a temple or whatever. Here you're running through it. Do you stop and take a look at certain things along the way? Do you make sure you plot an interesting course that'll take you through places that you really want to see? What kinds of stuff were you most interested in interacting with, engaging with, seeing, experiencing?
So that seems to and always evolves on its own, because you plot a route and you want to get from this side of a country to that side, and off you go.
Yeah.
But along the way, what unfolds is so amazing. It's actually the best way to do it is that surprise element. You'll come through a mountain range, and here's this most beautiful valley and this village and people you've never heard of, and you know, from a chef's perspective, food, and you end up in the middle of this feast and this ritual, and you just get washed up in it, and you might spend an extra day with these guys.
It's amazing. And you do cook, and you do partake in the local food and all of that stuff.
Yeah, in India, there'd be these massive weddings, and there'd be these huge pots, they're cooking ghee rice on the road, and I was there cooking rice for this wedding. We got invited to weddings. We were guests of honor at the main table next to the bride in our dirty running gear.
That's amazing.
We've had, I mean, in Madagascar, I was cooking fruit bats at some guy's house, and we ate tree boa constrictor they'd cooked in a fire. Locusts, they take sisal, and it's got this little thorn, and you pull it, and it's like a long thread.
Yeah.
And they thread all the locusts onto this thread, and they crunch salt in it, and then they cook it over the coals, and you eat these crunchy locusts, and it's stuff we've eaten.
That is crazy. Oh, boa constrictor can't taste nice.
It's and white also, puffy like, meat that's like it's like crocodile and creole mixed up.
God, how disgusting.
But also it's so unexpected, because it's like I think, ooh, these guys, they're on this ultra marathon, 60 kilometers a day, you've got to, you know, carb load and do eat special things and watch out for, and here you are just from wedding, from ghee rice, like ghee rice really.
No, you eat anything. You find it. And sometimes you eat stuff. We saw this fruit stand, and they were making the most beautiful fruit shakes. They had pineapples, bananas, granada, everything.
Where was this?
In India.
Okay.
And we were just craving for this. And then he took ice and he crushed it in. That's a problem. Never, ever take ice. We then saw ice plants later on. It's these huge, like steel platforms with steel cubes,
mm-hmm.
and the water runs in there, and guys are walking over this barefoot and sweating and dripping in this ice, and they're closing up all the ice and settling it.
Oh,
so basically this is
so
the ice
is where the disease comes
that's
from.
Where it comes. We got so sick. Hamish, who was crew with us, we flew him back. He had this intestinal infection. It took him about 4 or 5 weeks to recover from it. Within an hour afterwards, we were lying over this fence, and there was whatever coming out wherever it could.
Oh,
it was,
my God. Wow.
That Deli Belly Deluxe.
Jesus. And were you able to cook for them, I mean, in terms of showing them some of your things? Because you're a chef, so they must have been curious.
You'll go into people's homes, and you'll cook something, but it'll be whatever ingredients you find. And,
sure.
And even as crew, the amazing thing is we're sort of a hunter-gatherer. You get together what you can, and we all say we're going to meet at a campsite that evening, and then we'll all cook together whatever we've found.
Well, you've got a business and a company called I Like That, right? You manufacture food products for the international market, and apparently we can find your stuff in like 10 countries globally.
Yeah, so I've pulled out of that now.
You're not involved?
Yeah, I'm not involved in that anymore. Okay. Yeah, I've stuck mainly to my adventuring and
you could do this full time.
No.
What do you do the rest of the time?
The rest of the time I write books and I share my stories in the corporate market and then working with the foundation takes up a lot of my time. So you got to do lots of things. I do a bit of food consulting, and you know I've got a sort of a portfolio of jobs to keep myself.
Yeah, sounds like you're pretty busy.
Yeah, you got to try.
I have a question
everything.
About Cuba.
Yes, Guantanamo Bay.
That was a special trip. It was still before Cuba opened up, and it was a funny trip. We arrived in Cuba. So there as well, we arrived in Cuba. And we had this Facebook competition for a photographer, because we couldn't find a photographer, we couldn't find sponsorship, but we got a flight ticket, so we couldn't pay someone. So this guy wins the competition. He said, like, amazing, 1.5 month holiday to Cuba. All you got to do is take pictures and that. And we arrive in Cuba. Now we got nothing, no place to stay, no car, nothing. Eventually, we found a rental. This car was minute. I mean, Andy's tall. He's over 6 foot. He was lying in the back with all the gear with his feet out of this window. So we had to drive from Havana down to Guantanamo. And we thought it would, 1,000 Ks down from where we were, it'll take like a day. 4 days later, we're still driving. The roads are non-existent.
Wow.
So we get to Guantanamo, to the last village, only to find out that the lighthouse we were to start from was 15 Ks away, and it was through a military coffee plantation.
Wow.
Jesus.
So we left Pete in the crew vehicle, and we crept through this coffee plantation to the lighthouse, and then we ran back. So we'd done an extra like 15 Ks before the start. And we decided to go to the East Coast. Second night, we get arrested.
Oh, no.
And we were told by the military, you can't camp. So I thought, okay. So anyway, carried on. Then we ended in the city called Mao, which is their industrial hub, where they do a lot of military stuff. And bang, we get arrested again.
Yeah.
Caught camping again. And we couldn't work this out. And then we found, about 100 km further, we found a village. And they said, no, we could sleep there. And then that was it. Bang. The military came. They locked us up in a guest house. Then they drove us 90 kilometers to a city called Holgan, where the military central intelligence was there, and they interrogated us for 4 hours. And the guy took us one at a time, and he said, I'm going to interrogate all four of you. If any of these statements differ, we're going to lock you up for 18 months. Jeez. So they interrogate us all, and I look, and he says, okay, I'm going to sign this thing. And I look at it, but it's in Spanish. I said, I don't know what you've written there. I'm not going to sign it. He says, listen here. If you don't sign it, I'm going to lock you up. If I don't like it, I'm going to lock you up, so sign it.
Wow, you didn't have much option, huh?
We didn't have much option. So anyway, then they let us go, gave us back our passports, but every night we had a report into the military, and we had to stay in special accredited places where we could stay. But it was an amazing country. The vibe on Cuba, the buildings, the cars, the people, the food. I always say to people, go to Cuba as soon as you can. It's special. It was amazing. And, you know, when we were in Cuba, Madiba passed away. And a lot of the Cubans now had heard about these two South Africans running the country. People would run out in the villages and like, commiserate with us. And everywhere there were flags flying half-mast. They were saying, no, we're sorry, we hear your president passed away. And it was amazing. And that vibe on the island was unbelievable. And then we got to the north, to Vinales, to the main cigar farming area and rolling the cigars, and but the scenery, it's beautiful, that country, beautiful.
Sounds amazing. Where do you want to go next?
I've got two things planned. I've got my biggest journey ever planned for 2021.
Yeah.
It'll be in China. The Yangtze River from source to sea. We want to journey that. We want to run it, swim it, paddle it, sail it, whatever. It's 6,500 km, and we want to link an angle too of the climate change and actually how the Yangtze River has been regenerated. The river was nearly dead, and it's been regenerated, and amazing things are happening there. And we want to coincide that with the Chinese Winter Olympics, which is in 2022. So just do a nice story about what's happening there, and so we're looking at doing that.
So back to China again.
Yeah, but in October we're running from Namibia to Cape Town. We're going to do that journey, 20 marathons in 20 days to put 20 kids through surgery. So we're doing the 2020 with that. So it'll be a warm up run for that. Yeah.
Well, David, you're not having a boring time, huh?
No. Last at all. Eh?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's very inspiring. A lot of people sending messages here. Someone here says that they're so proud of you and the work you do. That's Natasha. Someone says, don't forget that all of this stuff is being done in one lifetime. You don't need to live for 500 years. Yeah. All right. Very nice. But David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks
this morning,
a lot.
David Greer. And Mbulelo, thanks for introducing us to him.
We will
have more on the bunch of winners in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, we'll have a great guy who's doing great things in Europe next week. Look out for that. He is, let's say, in the arts and doing massive things, a Pavarotti of our time.
Very nice.
South African, yeah.
Well, David,
thanks.
Are you running home or are you going to use transport?
No. I'm actually up here. We're putting up four medical little clinics up in Soweto and Hillbrow now. So the one project we're doing, we're putting up chronic med collection points to help the clinics decant well patients out of the units. We'll be rolling out 50 by the end of July.
That's phenomenal.
And on a yearly basis, we hope to be handing over nearly 2 million patient parcels. So you can imagine 2 million people we're assisting to decant out of clinics. So that's a big project we're doing. Amazing. So we're up here to do that, rolling those out. Yeah.
Yeah, and congratulations too on all the stuff that you've done in that area.
Thanks for having me, guys. It was great meeting
you. What a pleasure to meet you too. Very inspiring human being. CliffCentral.com